You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
It's Monday, 3 June. Local vehicle sales data, 2:30 this afternoon. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you live and loud from the MoneyWeb studios in Gauteng, Johannesburg. On the show today, Nokunzis from Sanlam Private Wealth. Results, Dis-Chem and Lewis, and I think they stand at different ends. Philip Short from Flagship Asset Management, talking the GLP-1 drugs, Eli Lilly and Novo Nordisk. And then Alec Cutler from Orbis Investments, finding investment options in AI that aren't NVIDIA. The show is brought to you by Stanlib. Visit stanlib.com to get in touch with one of their investment specialists. Stanlib Asset Management is an authorized financial services provider. Morning headlines for MoneyWeb. Capitec has its sights on the overseas market. Acquisition of Everfin will give it a geographical diversification. And Business Day, President Ramaphosa signs the two-pot law that overhauls retirement system. New law, retirement gives access to savings and is due on 1 September. Morning markets, US was mixed. S&P was up 0.8%, Nasdaq was down but 0.01% lower. Over in the east, we are green. Sydney 0.4% higher, Tokyo 0.9%, Hong Kong up 2.2%, and Tencent up 4.1%. Commodities mostly red. Gold $2,346 an ounce, Brent $81.41, platinum is the green at $1,048, and palladium at $9.18 an ounce. Rand is $18.70, 68,300 for Bitcoin, and top 40 opening call, 675 points to the upside. That is almost 1% green.
MoneyWeb Now, on the money. Also available on podcast.
Tony now with Nick Kunza, Sanlam Private Wealth. Nick, appreciate the early morning time. Dis-Chem results. I mean, revenue was up 11%, earnings slightly down. A lot of base effects still from the tail end of the pandemic and testing and vaccines and the like. But a PE of 27, I don't know, it looks a little eye-watering to me.
Yeah, morning, Simon. It is quite a difficult one. I'm always trying to unsure where to sort of pigeonhole this in the sector. Like, you know, where do you actually put this? You know, retailers or non-retail? It's quite a difficult one, and therefore, you know, how expensive or cheap should it be trading? But it is expensive, you know, almost a 30 PE. It doesn't give you much of a dividend yield. Granted, you know, it has grown EPS, you know, quite consecutively. Mm. It's a well-run business. But I guess, you know, for me, it's just a little bit too rich. You know, you are paying a lot for a business that, if you look at the commentary also as well that came out last week, Simon, you know, they are talking about obviously the same old story, you know, high interest rates, consumer under pressure, you know, and it just, for me, I think the risks sort of outweigh the costs of buying an expensive stock. And I guess you look at the year-to-date share price, you know, it's flat on the year, and I think maybe the market shares my sentiment maybe a little bit.
Yeah, I take a point on that. The flip side is Lewis, which isn't confusing. I don't know. Lewis is kind of like a bank masquerading as a furniture retailer, but a PE of 5, dividend yield of 11, massive share buybacks. They kind of know what their netting is. They stick to it. And even in these tough conditions, consumers under pressure, they do well.
They do very well. Look, it's a very, very well-run business. And to quote Mr. Buffett, you know, you buy management and you buy teams and you buy well-run businesses. This is a cracking business. The guys know the allocation of capital is world-class. They've, you know, if I look at a graph of EPS growth over the years, consecutive growths, and just a good value business and good value earnings, Simon. I mean, if you look at also, you know, despite, as you said, a consumer that, you know, might be a little bit under pressure in this particular market, you know, their net bad debts, if you look down into the small print, actually reduce those you know, in a high interest rate environment. So just a really well-run business, earnings per share up 50-odd%. And for me, compared to a Dis-Chem, you know, you're getting rewarded for taking risks that you might get wrong. You know, it's at 6.97 PE. and a dividend yield of close to 11%, is you are actually getting rewarded for any sort of downside risk. And again, another one, you know, up almost 9% year to date. So market shares it. But I think this is it continues to be an outperformer of the stock.
Yeah, and looking at the shares outstanding in 2017, 90 million, more or less. Today, 52 million. You're just getting more and more slice of it. We had final election results yesterday. As I said in the opening, the market's actually looking for a fairly strong open. My sense is it's probably going to be volatility this week on the market, on the bonds, on the currency, on almost everything.
All of the above. and then you throw in some macro stuff, Simon, with you know, jobs Friday, this Friday, ECB on Thursday. Obviously, more sort of color to the election results and the coalitions, who's going to partner with whom. I'd have to say I was a little bit nervous waking up this morning. But with the Rand at looking a little bit firmer, bonds looking a little bit better, markets looking a little bit stronger, I think there's a little bit of calmness after the crazy sort of 48 hours. But to your point, I do think, you know, fasten your seatbelt, guys. It's going to be a volatile week, definitely.
Yeah, and I shared that nervousness this morning. I looked at the data and it was like, this actually looks fairly good. Nick Kunze, Sanlam Private Wealth, appreciate the early morning time.
When you stay invested over time in Stanlib's Global Multi-Strategy Diversified Growth Fund, your money's in for some smooth sailing. With our global partners, JP Morgan Asset Management at the helm, your money can withstand the pressure and bad weather day-to-day market conditions cause. All aboard? Seek more returns at stanlib.com/more. Stanlib Asset Management is an authorized financial services provider.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
I'm chatting with Philip Shorty's flagship asset management fund manager. Philip, appreciate the time today. The GLP drugs, or GLP-1 drugs, and they started as drugs and now they moved into weight loss. They've now also been discovered that they actually help protect kidney function of overweight individuals or heart disease patients. I mean, this drug is frankly just getting better and better.
Yes, and that's not all. I mean, it also improves cardiovascular health, apparently also with what helps with arthritis, some liver diseases, Alzheimer's. I mean, these are all in the testing phases, but they have showed up in patients that have been using it for weight loss.
And the key thing, I mean, there's Eli Lilly and there's Novo Nordisk. I mean, Novo Nordisk, we look at that price earnings of 37 times. You make the point that there's actually a huge amount of potential here. I mean, the penetration rate in the US market is like 1.5%. There is a long way to go still.
Yes, so I mean, if we look at today, so their mainstream anti-obesity drug was launched in 2021. And as you say, the US penetration rate is 1.5%, with the obesity rate in the States being 40%. So that's anything with a BMI over 30. And you're looking, their main exposure, they are in some other markets in Europe, but their main markets where they started was the US. So if you're looking, there's massive runway for growth, looking at the penetration rate versus the obesity rate, and that is basically just weight loss. And if we're looking at some of the other areas, I mean, I read that over 850 million people in the world have some sort of kidney disease. So now you've got this new result that shows that they can help with kidney diseases or reduce the severity of kidney diseases. That's a whole new market that you're opening up and not even commercially released yet. That's still in trial. So it looks optically expensive, but there's a long runway of growth.
Yeah, I take your point. And we tend to focus on their home countries. We tend to focus on the US. There is still the rest of the world. I mean, my sense is they need, you know, clean facilities to make these. But that's not like you're trying to buy NVIDIA chips to make it. I mean, they've got scale capacity, I imagine.
Actually, no. So what actually got me interested in the stock, one of the things that got me really interested in the stock was when I realized that they had a global shortage and that you couldn't get hold of Wegovy, their main anti-obesity drug, and globally for like 3 months. So they have severe supply constraints, which they're actually still busy sorting out now. And one of the first moves they did earlier this year was buying out another company, a contract manufacturer, just so they can get capacity to roll this out. So that's the other reason that's going to support earnings growth, is as they sort out the supply issues, they're going to be rolling out the drugs quicker.
We also see Novo Nordisk, they're paying a dividend, they're doing a share buyback. Importantly, and I was completely unaware of this, they have no debt and they've got a return on equity of 88%, which I imagine one has to double check those numbers because it seems impossible, but they're just in the right space. I mean, it's a staggering number.
It is. I mean, and just to put it into context, you know, we talk a lot about ROEs and other metrics, but I mean, for every that they retain, they're earning 88 cents on that, you know, if your ROE is 88. Yeah. 88%. So that in itself, I mean, you almost don't want them to pay a dividend, because where else are you going to find a place where you can get an 88% return on your dollar? So that's a very high ROE. It shows that they have places to invest money internally to grow. But yeah, gross margins are over 80%. EBITDA margins are over 40%, close to 50%. And as you say, the net debt is zero. So yeah, very attractive metrics.
It's almost that perfect example of a balance sheet. We've been chatting Novo Nordisk. Of course, the other one is Eli Lilly. I mean, is there a preference? I mean, is Novo Nordisk quantifiably the better, or is it potentially a bit of each?
So we hold both in our global flexible funds. We do have a preference for Novo Nordisk. The metrics are better in terms of the ROEs, the gross margins, the EBITDA margins, mm-hmm. as well as the balance sheet is a bit stronger. And then it's also quite a bit cheaper as well. And Novo Nordisk did have first mover advantage in this anti-obesity drug market. Mm-hmm. But yeah, they're both good. I just think we have a slight preference for Novo Nordisk.
Slight preference for Novo Nordisk. We'll leave it there. That's Philip Short. He's a fund manager, Flagship Asset Management. Philip, appreciate the time. And that's the question we're asking you today on our LinkedIn and Twitter. Is it Eli Lilly? Is it Novo Nordisk? Is it bits of both? Certainly these GLP-1 drugs just seem to be getting better and better and able to do more and more. Have your vote, have your say, LinkedIn and Twitter.
Your money can do more when it's investing with conviction. Our partnership with JP Morgan Asset Management gives you access to in-depth, broad market research and high-return investment strategies. So invest in a select set of companies with long-term structural growth potential with StanLib's Global Growth Fund. Seek more returns at stanlib.com/more. StanLib Asset Management is an authorized financial services provider.
MoneyWeb now, on the money.
Chatting with Alec Cutler from Orbis Investments. Alec, appreciate the time today. US tech, Magnificent Seven, but truthfully broader than that. US tech has captured everyone's imagination. Valuations are somewhere between stretched and probably very stretched. Where's Orbis finding opportunity outside of US tech when you look at global markets?
We find great opportunity all around the world, really. Japan, Korea, UK valuations are quite low. But I think most interestingly, we find great opportunity right around that hotbed of US tech, in that everyone is fascinated with AI and they mention NVIDIA and Microsoft all the time. But what they don't talk much about is who's providing the weapons to them. They're all fighting it out to see who can be the number one or number two in AI. But in those kinds of instances, when there are Magnificent Seven names trying to all be number one or be number two, I want to provide the weapons and ammunition. And that lies underneath them in the form of semiconductors. So NVIDIA, who everyone loves, doesn't make anything. Mm-hmm. NVIDIA designs chips that Taiwan Semiconductor makes. And Taiwan Semiconductor is the only company in the world that can make them. And yet Taiwan Semiconductor, A, has sells at one-third the multiple, the valuation of an NVIDIA. And B, should competitors arise, which they inevitably will, mm-hmm. there's no barrier to entry that says that Taiwan Semiconductor can't make them for them as well. They're completely mm-hmm. indifferent as to who they make these fancy chips for. The second set of semiconductors that provides this ring around the AI opportunity are the memory companies. And if you think about AI, AI is really about super fast processing mm-hmm. of information and then getting that information in and out very, very quickly, lots and lots of information. That is where DRAM memory is incredibly important. So if you look at an NVIDIA chipset, you'll see connected to that chip are massive amounts of high bandwidth memory. The companies that make those are selling for very low valuations, and they happen to be an oligopoly in Micron, Samsung, and Hynix, so two Korean companies and an American company. That's kind of the first place we're finding opportunity. And those names are selling at 10 times earnings, so very cheap multiple. You don't need to look very far away from AI to find some terrific, very reasonably valued opportunities.
I take your point. The old cliche, in the gold rush, you wanted to be the person selling the shovels. You probably only made 50 cents a shovel, but you sold enough of them to work that through. One of the other big stories out there, which is off tack from AI and the like, but is the trend towards deglobalization and that sort of trend. And there must be, I mean, the one obvious one again is copper, right? Because we're going to need power and all of that. But again, that seems almost too obvious. That's like the Magnificent Seven. Opportunities sort of around that space where we sort of learned our lessons during the pandemic.
I think even though they're obvious, so certainly copper, but if you think about onshoring, you're building factories, you're building rail lines and roads to those factories, you're upgrading the port facilities, or you're upgrading the electricity, transmission and generation. It's just a massive amount of infrastructure. And I think the markets are ignoring those names still because they're considered to be dirty old industrials that don't mesh well with zero carbon world in a very simplistic way. Mm-hmm. But the irony being that without them, you don't get to that nirvana of a zero carbon world. You need a Prysmian to make high voltage cable lines. You need Siemens Energy to make transformers and switches. You need MasTec to dig up the ground and bury the power lines and the natural gas pipes. There are many, many companies that are very well run, that sell for very low valuations, that have a direct connection to this reshoring theme.
I take the point. Yeah, and again, we're sort of back to the shovels there. One of the things, inflation is sort of muddling along, and we're not going back to, I suspect, the very low inflation of pre-pandemic. We kind of reset a new inflation level. This almost brings into a broader theme around portfolio construction and multi-asset portfolios. And of course, those other assets are, it's equity, but it's cash and bonds, which sort of fit very well into the future as we look out, which includes wars in Europe and the Middle East amongst our challenges.
Yeah, fixed income is very challenging right now because, one, we've become used to over the last 40 years of having a low and ever lower interest rate environment, which allows fixed income securities and to diversify versus equity securities. But when inflation's a bit higher, above 4%, bonds and equities are correlated, so they don't help each other out from a diversification standpoint. Mm. The second thing is, when we look at developed market treasuries, government sovereigns, they're kind of yielding around 4 to 4.5%. And the inflation expectation that the market holds right now is 2 to 2.2%. We look at that and we think it's, well, quite frankly, BS. We think the inflation on average over the next 20 years is going to be, you know, nowhere near that. We think it's going to be on average between 4, 4.5, maybe even 5%. Mm. In which case, if you believe that, then you're not going to touch these treasuries. So we're nowhere near them. And instead, you know, we find solace in gold, in hedging out our equity exposure, other ways to generate a diversifying outcome away from equities.
I take your point. And certainly that higher inflation over the decades ahead, it changes lots fundamentally. And to your point, makes those seemingly attractive yields not quite so attractive. We'll leave it there. That's Alec Cutler. He's from Orbis Investments. Alec, appreciate the time. That's it for today. A lot of my guests recently talking that higher inflation. And the story behind it is fairly compelling. We were chatting with Shirish Khan from Old Mutual Investment Group on Friday. Her argument around the three drivers is going to be that decarbonization, deglobalization, and the demographic. And they are big trends. And the sense is that they're going to create that higher inflation. We asked you on LinkedIn and Twitter, do you think we are entering a prolonged period of higher inflation? Not hyper, but higher. Just over half of you said yes, very much so, you think so. A quarter said, well, it's kind of hard to tell. And I'll take the point around that. The rest said, no, it will go lower. Everything will be okay. Have your vote, have your say, LinkedIn and Twitter. This show is brought to you by StanLib. Visit stanlib.com to get in touch with one of their investment specialists. StanLib Asset Management is an authorized financial services provider. We're live every weekday morning. The MoneyWeb website's in the app, 6:30 a.m. podcast just after 7. Thanks to my team, Eddie, Nobokhle, Nicole, to you for listening, my guests for their time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. If you're loving the show, please leave us a positive rating and a great review in your podcatcher of choice. And we'll chat again tomorrow. Bond markets.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.